Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at CedarPoint.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And ooh, do you feel that tingling? I think it's Saturday. It's time for a Vault episode. And this one is about that warm, tingly feeling of Kamamuda.
Yes, here come the warm feels. This was an episode that originally published 1/21/2020. And I do remember this one. I remember this one being a lot of fun.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we're going to be looking at a subject that I started thinking about in terms of a broader question. And the question is this. Are there unexplored frontiers in understanding what human emotions are? When you think about human emotions, that is something that's studied by psychology and sometimes by neuroscience. But it seems like territory where we just assume we've got all the basics down, right? We know happy, sad, we know contempt, we know disgust. There's a broad range of basic emotions, and we just think it's intuitive that, yeah, we've got names for all of them. We understand basically what they are. We've felt them before. But there is, of course, something that we all know, that there is a feeling understanding gap, that we can feel things without necessarily understanding what they are or why we're feeling them. It's why we're sometimes like surprised by our own emotions, like when you discover without realizing it that you'd been falling in love with someone, or you discover without realizing it that someone actually really gets on your nerves and, you know, it's finally all coming into focus, or, you know, all kinds of feelings like that, that you can feel for a long time before you have any kind of cognitive awareness or ability to describe or put a name to it. And it makes you wonder if there are whole emotional states that we go through. We feel them, but we don't necessarily have a language for them or an understanding of their relationship to external stimuli and the symptoms they produce in the body and the mind.
Yeah, there's a great deal of complexity to this, because on one hand, yeah, there's just the awareness of self, being able to enter at least into moments of awareness, moments of self-awareness. And then there's, of course, this idea of being aware of your awareness and how that
changes your ability to self-reflect and, you know, varying degrees of awareness as well. But, you know, I was thinking a little bit on this, and I feel like to a certain extent, it's kind of like transparent anatomical overlays that you'll find in like an anatomy book, you know, where like the base is the skeleton, and then you have like a transparent overlay that then puts, I don't know, the circulatory system, and then you know, add other systems or muscular layers on top of that.
You're getting very Tool album art on me, Robert.
Right. Yeah,
I know your mind.
Obviously, this has also been explored in Tool album art as well. Yes, by the excellent visionary artist Alex Gray, of course.
Yeah, but there is actually something pretty interesting about that art, which is that it layers real anatomical strata of things you would see like muscles and blood vessels and nerves and all that with other things that are non-physical. They're, you know, abstract. It layers on sort of concepts of the soul on top of the body in another transparent overlay.
Right. And so I can't help but think about that in terms of feelings, language, and awareness, because there's certainly the experience of an emotional state that we have. And then there's another transparent page that we can put on top of that, representing like a person-shaped word cloud that provides a definition and an analysis as well of what I'm feeling. Though perhaps, you know, we also need a second overlay to really have capture that second part, you know, what our culture is saying about what we think we're feeling and how we should feel about it. And then on top of all of this, we have awareness and the awareness of awareness and the knowledge that this entire page is going to turn, that this state, whatever it is, is going to be fleeting, no matter how much we want it to last forever or how much we dread that it will last forever. And I think it can sometimes go something like this, right? I feel something, and then my language gives that feeling a name, say sadness. And then my culture tells me that, say, sadness that I'm feeling is inappropriate for my gender or inappropriate for a given situation, et cetera. And then I yearn for other labeled emotional states. And somehow this linguistic tag does not summon the emotion I want. It doesn't generate it out of nowhere. And then I'm sad and ashamed for being sad. So basically, the short of it is there's this relationship between how we label our emotions and the emotions we feel. And also it does that thing that language does, right? We're able to tag something for further study. We're able to take something that is difficult to explain. We put a single label on it, and then we can discuss that label in comparison to other subjects and other examples, et cetera.
Well, yeah. Once you name something, you can start to figure out what it is and what it is not. Mm-hmm. If you didn't have a name for the thing, it's a lot harder to start trying to describe the characteristics it does or doesn't possess.
Yeah, and like as a parent, I have encountered this, you know, where my son is feeling something, and either, you know, he doesn't have the self-awareness and self-reflection to really think about it yet, or perhaps he doesn't even have a good word, a good description for what it is he's feeling. Mm-hmm. And you have to sort of try and walk them through what they're feeling and try to get them to identify it so that you can discuss it, so you can get to the bottom of it to whatever extent you can.
I think that naming of things, especially naming of internal states, can have tremendous and often – well, tremendous positive and negative power. One example of positive power I think of is – I'm not going to say who, but just somebody I know. At one point when they became aware of the psychological concept of rumination, you know, the process of repeatedly going over cycles of negative thoughts in your mind and entertaining worst possible scenarios – just becoming aware that that was a concept that was already known of and had a name had a lot of power for this person to help them overcome it when it was affecting them, because suddenly they didn't just think, oh, I'm doing this terrible thing again. They thought, I'm ruminating.
Right.
This is a psychological symptom that's negative. And they felt it was easier to break out of the cycle after knowing the word for it.
Exactly. And to come back to sadness, for example, like it's one thing to realize I am feeling sad. Mm-hmm. But then language allows us then to focus in on more specific versions of that, saying, you know, not only am I feeling sadness, perhaps I'm feeling the particular sadness of loss or rejection or homesickness or defeat or alienation. And then we can better utilize our own minds and even resources either in the community or or in just sort of the general human world around us to try and figure out how we should react and or solve the situation at hand.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that makes me think of another thing you're sort of alluding to there, which is that when you have a name for an internal state, that helps you find other people who also experience the internal
right.
state, because you sort of have a common search term or something that you can use to get together and figure out, oh, okay, and you can compare your experiences with others. And of course, you know, again, this cuts both ways. I'd say overall it's probably a positive thing to have names for internal states like this, because it can help people find solidarity, get advice from other people who feel the same way they do. But it can also lead to, you know, people finding one another based on like anger-based or, you know, negative internal states and building a kind of negative solidarity of stoking one another's bad emotions.
Right. Or what happens when you have a legitimate emotional state, but the terminology you end up using to describe it is not helpful. Say that you end up using, like, say, highly religious terminology to describe these things
mm-hmm.
that in some cases may not provide a lot of tools for dealing with it. Like, what if you broadly categorize various emotional states as being sinful?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then that means that your only ways of really addressing whatever you're feeling lie within the religious doctrine that you are in which you're classifying everything and limits you in that respect.
Or believing that, say, a state like depression or something consists of having a demon.
Right.
Which, you know, you can certainly understand why it could feel that way.
And yet on the other side, there are examples of personifying negative emotional states that can be liberating, you know, being able to say personify one's fear and then reject it.
Yeah.
So it's certainly, when you're talking about human emotional states and our awareness of them and our dealings with them, there's a great deal of complexity here. There's not necessarily a one size fits all. We're not going to be able to unwrap all of these questions today, but we will discuss an emotional state that has largely gone unnamed, at least in the English language.
Yeah, at least if this group of researchers that we're going to be talking about today are on to something. So I came to this topic today of emotions that we don't yet have names for by reading an article in Eon by the psychological anthropologist Alan Fisk, who is a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles. And in this article, Fisk summarizes a bunch of research that's been going on in the past few years, a lot of which he's been a co-author on, which he believes identifies an extremely important everyday emotion, not something unusual, but something we all know, we feel all the time, that's incredibly important to our lives, that's been with us all along, but that he argues has not been recognized as distinct and unified as an emotion in itself, and instead has been called a lot of kind of other things in its different facets. And the term he uses for this emotion is kamamuta, K-A-M-A-M-U-T-A. So what exactly is kamamuta, as Fisk would argue? The term kamamuta comes from ancient Sanskrit, in which it means moved by love. So this emotion of kamamuta is a social emotion, and Fisk describes it as an emotion evoked by the sudden intensification of communal sharing. Now, this doesn't just mean sharing in the sense of like sharing your toys or sharing your Kit Kat bar or sharing the payout from the bank heist, though all of those could probably be moments that would evoke kamamuta, but this is a broader sense of sharing. This is what Alan Fisk has called in other work communal sharing relationships, and that's briefly defined in one of his papers as relationships, quote, in which participants feel that in some distinctive way they are equivalent, belong together, care for, and trust each other. So it's sort of like a strengthening of social bonds and a signaling of trust and mutual caring.
This is why you do trust falls at your place of work, right?
You know, you would think this makes me think of a funny thing I kind of want to come back to later in the episode, which is like ways that if this is truly a unified emotional experience in the way they're describing, ways that it is definitely exploited in business and in media. Mm-hmm. One thing that I know you and I have talked about before is all the things that love to tell you they're your family but are not your family.
Right.
Like your workplace that says like we're a family. And mm-hmm. I understand that can be a nice thing to say. Like you're trying to say, you know, oh, you should feel belonging here. But, you know, people actually have families that are families. Or, you know, if Olive Garden says when you're here, you're family. There's something in common there. They're trying to do something to you. What is that thing they're trying to do?
Yeah, they're co-opting the idea of family. And here's another one: the Saw is family. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre series franchise will sometimes pull that one out, and I'm like, I don't know, maybe it is, but probably not.
Oh no, Drayton's being manipulative when he says that. He's trying to turn Leatherface into a bitter old woman hater like he is. But okay. So there are lots of separate emotional states that we recognize that Fisk argues actually all share the features of this one unified thing that he's proposing, this unified state of kama mutta. And so different examples of words people use for this thing that he actually says is all the same thing is being moved, being touched, team pride, patriotism, being touched by the spirit, burning in the bosom, the feels, I like that. Or he says also, when evoked by memory, it's nostalgia.
So that's a lot of ground to cover. I feel, for instance, I feel nostalgic when I think about movies from, say, 1986. I feel a sense of communal belonging when I'm, say, in church or I'm in a yoga class. And when I'm hugging my wife and child, I feel something that I might describe as loved belonging or, to some extent, you know, structural completeness.
Yeah, there are obviously a lot of different scenarios here that he's saying are all going to evoke this one emotion he's talking about. So maybe we should drill down into the details of how he describes this emotion and its symptoms in order to understand better what exactly it is he's talking about.
So, all right, let's roll through it.
Well, wait, no. Maybe we should take a break first, and then when we come back, we can look at the features he lists.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it.
I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
All right, we're back. So we're talking about Kamamuta, and we're going to begin to roll into the six features that occur together in this broad categorization of emotional states.
Right, as argued by the anthropologist Alan Fiske. So there have been a bunch of studies on this. We're going to look at a few of the studies individually in a moment here. But just to start off at the top level, what are the main takeaways? Fiske argues that Kamamuta is described by six features that occur together. And he says, so first of all, it's evoked by, quote, the sudden intensification of communal sharing. And again, sharing, that's not just like sharing materials, but this thing that I mentioned earlier, situations where participants feel in some distinctive way that they're equivalent, belong together, care for, and trust each other. Broadly, situations that we would describe as examples of love.
And to a certain extent, you could think of this as a – you could think of communion as an example of this, right?
Sure.
Or you could think of a potluck dinner as an example of this. You know, I don't know. I guess one of the things is that it has to spark that feeling, right, for it to be real. You could have an overly ritualized version of anything that is then devoid of the emotional resonance.
It makes me think of the Eddie Izzard joke about singing hallelujah in the Anglican church. No offense to Anglicans. You know, mm-hmm. I have great love for the Anglicans. But, you know, he's got this whole bit about them singing hallelujah. I think the point he makes is a good one, which is that, like, something that's supposed to be an overwhelming outpouring of spontaneous joy can, if ritualized in a certain kind of way, become rather drab.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Because on the other end of it, when people come together in song, like that is a great way to potentially feel this shared emotional state.
Absolutely,
because we are becoming one voice.
Okay, so it's evoked by this sudden moment of communal sharing where you feel a belonging, a trust, and a love with other people, but. The next point he says is that it very crucially, this emotion is brief. He says it typically lasts less than a minute or two, though it can keep repeating in rapid succession. So like you'll get a burst of it. It's less than a minute or two long. You can do it again, but it's not something that, you know, lasts all day. And I think this is one thing that that makes it very important here. It's distinct from love itself, the way Fiske describes it. Fiske says the important distinction is that love is an enduring sentiment. It's more like a kind of like semi-permanent state of affairs that sticks with you beyond the moment to moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's always important to remember that love endures even as a variety of emotions play out. Not to say that love is impervious to fleeting emotional states, but it does not inherently vanish when happiness fades. rage or anger seeps in, etc.
Yeah, and that's one of the really interesting and special things about love, right? That you can like love somebody even when you're angry at them or right. something like that. But in contrast to that, he says Kamamuta is this intense momentary flare-up of emotion that occurs when love is shared. So when something happens that signals that the sharing of love has intensified, and again, this love can be between two people. It can be between a deer and a dog. It can be between – seriously, you know, all these videos on internet of like a deer and a dog playing together. In Fisk's terms, these are pure Kamamuta porn. We're just watching these moments of like of social reciprocal trust and bonding between, you know, species that you might not expect or something. Or it can be not even that personal. It can be between a large group of people who feel solidarity and common purpose. A big thing that features into this is the invocation of Kamamuta in political contexts, like, say, in a demonstration or a march. People will often feel the exact same symptoms we're about to get into that are described as typical of Kamamuta, this, you know, burning in the bosom for a feeling of togetherness with all these people who share a common purpose.
Now, on the detail of it being fleeting, I wonder if it is fleeting because, like other emotional states, it kind of eludes awareness. I always come back to the Cormac McCarthy quote. I think this was from All the Pretty Horses that goes, quote, "If you want to see it, you have to see it on its own ground. If you catch it, you lose it. And where it goes, there is no coming back from. Not even God can bring it back." And the metaphor that he's exploring here is that of a snowflake, that you cannot catch the snowflake. You can only experience it in the moment, and you can't catch or keep it. And that's often what it feels like with happiness, right? You're feeling good. Then you think, hey, I'm feeling good. And then it begins to run away. You know, it's like, don't look directly at the happiness or you will scare it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, one of the things is that I don't think you can improve a moment of happiness by examining it. Mm-hmm. But I do think by examining happiness generally, maybe that can be a good thing. Like if you try to look at any individual moment and become analytical about it, it undercuts the emotional power of it. But maybe it is good to have a pre-existing understanding or awareness of emotional states that come from examining previous versions of that emotion.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think understanding the fleeting nature of happiness is key to being able to have a healthy relationship with happiness.
Yeah. Like you don't get happy by thinking about wanting to be happy.
Right. But I also don't want to make it – I don't want to imply, though, that – happiness is disrupted by awareness, that you would necessarily just remain on this happiness high if you weren't able to then to self-reflect on it, because I don't think that's the case.
Right.
I get the impression that these bursts of Kamamuta, if we're going to use that term, they are supposed to be bursts.
Yeah. Well, like all emotions, I mean, all these emotions are fleeting. That's what makes, again, these individual emotions different than these longer sentiments or states that we hold in our minds, like love.
Right. I mean, it comes back to sensory information as well. It's like when you taste a strawberry, you're not happy for 6 years straight following it. It's a burst of flavor, a burst of understanding, and it makes sense that our emotional states would follow similar patterns.
Okay. What are the next four characteristics? So we've got that it's evoked by the sudden communal sharing. We've got that it is brief and fleeting. The next thing is, of course, that it feels good. This emotion is inherently pleasurable, and people seek whenever they're able to repeat it. They want to keep having it over and over.
Right. And if you can monetize it, all the better, right?
No, all the more evil. So it feels good. It's naturally pleasurable, even though there's a thing that it's often part of a bittersweet kind of feeling, something that we do have a name for, that it feels good even when being kind of in the near proximity to or the context of recognizable negative emotions like sadness.
Yeah, we've talked about this in the show before in context to say nostalgia.
Yeah.
There's something else we talked about recently, there being like the bittersweet aspect to it. It was thankfulness.
Oh, yes, of course. Gratitude. Yeah, absolutely.
There's a sense of – there's a vulnerability to these moments, such as like embracing family members. Like there is like this sort of hyper like meta feeling, like all the – all the possibilities, all the potential and an actual past and future joys and sadness and tragedies all just bundled up into a single snap of the finger, you know?
Yeah.
You kind of feel all of that at once, which can be overwhelming. Like, imagine if that wasn't just a burst.
Yeah.
That would be, it can be overwhelming even as a burst of emotion.
Okay, the next thing that the research has found here is that Kamamuda is accompanied by a very consistent characteristic set of physical sensations in the body and physical symptoms and behaviors. So one is a warm, fuzzy feeling in the center of the chest. Another is tearing up, of course, is crying, moistness in the eyes. Another is being choked up, a lump in the throat, which often goes along with the tears in the eyes. Another is chills or goosebumps. One is a smile or putting a palm on the chest. And one is the expression, especially in English, of awe.
Yeah, awe is a big one, because when we coo awe at the sight of a kitten, we're generally inviting those among us to share in this moment with us, or mm-hmm. we're signaling solidarity with it. You know, with the kitten or whatever the cute embodiment happens to be.
That's a good point. We should come back to that in a minute, because I feel like cuteness doesn't fit into this framework quite as obviously as most of the other things that trigger it do. But I think there might be good reasons, and I think you're definitely onto something there. So the next thing is that it actually is a motivating emotion. It motivates devotion and, Fisk says, compassion to communal sharing, also known as loving kindness. Hmm. So it generally, like what these studies have found, one of the studies I was looking at, so is if you show people video of two people having like a communal sharing experience that causes this emotion in the viewer also feels an increased sense of community with the two characters, these other characters being observed. And then another one is that there are common types of expressions across many languages that basically translate to something like this. It means being moved in its various translations, or mm-hmm. being touched in various translations. Like, that all often refers to something having to do with this idea. So I want to say, at first glance, in reading about this, I resonate strongly. Like, I know exactly what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if it is that we needed a new term for it. Maybe we did. I'm not sure if I'm decided on that issue or not. But I'm not sure what term you would use otherwise. Maybe you could just try to lump it under one of these sort of capturing it pre-existing things like feeling moved or something.
Yeah.
That might be kind of broader than what exactly this is talking about. But this experience and all of the aspects of it that he lists feel absolutely real in my own experience.
Oh, absolutely. The emotional experience is certainly real. Any disagreement we have is just about like to what extent this categorization is useful, to what extent we can actually group all of these things under this big umbrella mm-hmm. of Kamamuda.
Yeah, I think I'm undecided about that, but we can explore it more as we go on.
By the way, none of this is to be confused with the Muda scale.
The Muda scale.
Yes, which anyone out there who is a pro wrestling fan might be familiar with. Muda scale is an unofficial means of measuring how much blood a pro wrestler has bled via blading or juicing. That's when a professional wrestler will intentionally cut their forehead with a razor, or sometimes there is more like of a hard juicing technique where it's by actually bumping into something. But they will intentionally cut themselves on the forehead. The blood will flow. The blood will mix with sweat and create quite a visual display of a bloody face, or a crimson mask, as it's sometimes called.
I feel like this is not something you're supposed to do in the main circuits, right?
It's not done as much these days, certainly in modern pro wrestling companies, like mainstream pro wrestling companies, because, of course, there are a number of objections one can make to intentionally bleeding all over the place, right?
Right.
But on the other hand, it is a highly physical performance, and therefore people will get busted open accidentally, and sometimes the show goes on despite a little blood.
Now, is the Muda scale named after – does it come from Sanskrit?
No. It comes – basically it's of Japanese origin because it's referring to a pro wrestler, a legendary pro wrestler out of Japan by the name of Keiji Muto, who would also perform, especially in the United States, as the Great Muda. And it's referring in particular to a 1990 New Japan Pro Wrestling match with Hiroshi Hase, in which Muda blades and just gets a really brilliant crimson mask all over his face. His face is just covered in blood. And so a
it
lot
looks
of
like Kane.
Yeah, it does have that kind of look. It reminds one a lot of various face painting scenarios. But it had such an impact on pro wrestling fans of that time period, they kind of decided this would be the starting point for considerations of any blade job. Where is it on the Muda scale? Is it like a 3 or a 4? Does it go beyond the type of bloodletting that Muda shows off in this match? It's different from Kama Muda. But at the same time, I think a given scenario like this match, you could have the performer themselves feeling a sense of Kama Muda. You could have the audience viewing this spectacle certainly feeling this communal sense of Kama Muda. You know, you're all a part of this big sporting event. It's kind of it's not quite patriotism, but like a unity of love for the performance or for one of the two or both performers.
Oh, I think it's absolutely there in fan communities of things. Yeah, people feel a solidarity with their fellow fans based on their shared interests. There's an inference of kind of like shared values and common cause, even if that might not necessarily be the case. It kind of feels that way.
Right. Like if you're a pro wrestling fan, if you knew what the Muda scale was, you knew who the Great Muda is, then perhaps when I mentioned it, you felt a little bit of that. You felt this connection to me and you knew that we shared something in this this brotherhood of blood. All right. On that note, we're going to take a break. But when we come back, we will jump back in to the Kama Muda.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with 3 rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed.
And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. All right, we're back. I figured we should just take a brief glance at a few of the studies out there in the journals about Kamamuda, this emerging idea of this unifying emotion based on the intensification of communal sharing. So the first one that I wanted to bring up is by Fisk et al. In Emotion Review, published in 2019, called The Sudden Devotion Emotion, Kamamuda and the Cultural Practices Whose Function is to Evoke It. And this paper briefly, it argues that, quote, cultures have evolved diverse practices, institutions, roles, narratives, arts, and artifacts whose core function is to evoke Kamamuda. And it also argues that Kamamuda, quote, mediates much of human sociality. And I think this is probably right, right? I mean, whether or not, like, the term is the right term to use, a huge amount of media and culture and art is based on this. It's like watching people in the act of this sudden intensification of communal emotion and bonding.
Yeah, like I'm reminded of the various Super Bowl ads that come out, like the really emotionally manipulative ones that have like animals coming together or people and their pets, et cetera. It brings people together, perhaps so you can sell a product to them. But still, the images themselves, the idea, the story, the music, it all comes together to create this this shared feeling. Now, this paper in particular does specifically mention cuteness as one of these cultural models.
Oh, yeah.
And we've certainly discussed cuteness on our podcast in the past, especially as it concerns monsters and the cutification of formerly horrifying monsters.
Yeah, this is an interesting question. Like, why does cuteness seem to evoke all the same psychological and physiological symptoms as Kamamuda, brought on by more traditional stimuli, which would include either like communal sharing between one person and another, or communal sharing between observed others. Just to go quickly to another paper, and then we can come back to this because this has to do with cuteness. There's this other one called Too Cute for Words, Cuteness Evokes the Heartwarming Emotion of Kamamuda, published in Frontiers in Psychology in 2019. And the authors there hypothesize that cuteness is a type of stimulus that makes people feel an automatic sense of communal sharing with the cute entity just based on the aesthetics of cuteness alone. It's in line with some of the biological theory about the nature of cuteness, which says that cuteness is a series of visual schema designed to make adults feel like obligated to take care of the cute thing and to watch out for its best interests. So the cute face asks you for help without any words, and you just feel compelled to comply. And it's the assumption of that relationship, they hypothesize, that provides the Kamamuda link here. That's why cuteness feels in a way communal.
The latest cultural example of this, I think, would be the child, aka Baby Yoda, from the television series The Mandalorian. Which
spoilers, please?
Yes. Now you haven't.
I haven't been on the internet, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's impossible to avoid the spoiler that there is a creature that is unofficially called Baby Yoda in the show. It is never called that in the show. It's just called the child or the asset. And yeah, you look at it and it really pulls at your heartstrings. It is really cute. And it shares some screen time with none other than Werner Herzog, the acclaimed German director and occasional actor.
Also very cute.
He's menacing. Let's make no two. Let's not lie about that.
Overwhelming collective murder.
but I think he explained it well via IndieWire when he was talking about sharing screen time with the child. He said, "It is a phenomenal technological achievement, but beyond the technological achievement, it's heartbreaking." And apparently, when he learned that they were going to shoot alternate takes of these scenes in case they wanted to replace the puppet child with a CGI child, he reportedly told them, quote, "You are cowards. Leave it." And ultimately,
that's the Werner Herzog I love.
But yes, the child is very cute, and the show is terrific as well. But to come back to that that paper, The Sudden Devotion Emotion, this is what they had to say about cuteness in Kamamuda. Quote, "The fact that cuteness, vulnerability, and need evoke Kamamuta makes sense given our assumption that the phylogenetic source of Kamamuta is maternal bonding to newborns. The generativity of human Kamamuta makes it flexibly adaptive. This explains why Kamamuta occurs in response to babies, kittens, marriage proposals and weddings, rituals of solidarity, religious moments of union with divinities, homecomings and reunions, the kindness of strangers, sentimental narratives and cinema, addiction recovery groups, team spirit moments in war and sports, oratory, marketing, choral singing, making and listening to music, dancing, rowing, and so forth."
I see it, though. I see it. Yeah, there is this through line in like all those things they mentioned that I would not have unified in my mind before, but now it makes sense to me. This concept is interesting to me because there is something I feel that's similar when something is very cute versus when I have like a moment of personal love and connection versus when I'm part of like a political moment that feels positive and significant with many other people. Mm-hmm. Like those things seem so different. What would be unified between them? Why are there these similar sensations in the body and kind of feelings in the brain?
Well, there's a way to bring these together, Joe, and that is Baby Yoda 2020, obviously. It's got my vote.
That thing is going to be used to sell the world's awfulest atrocities.
No. Baby Yoda is a wholly blameless creature.
Okay. To look briefly at another paper that Fisk was involved in, another one is Fisk et al. In Evolutionary Studies in Imaginative Culture in 2017 called "The Best Love Story of All Time, Overcoming All Obstacles to Be Reunited, Evoking Kamamuda." And basically here they just point out that if you go back through the history of literature, one of the most common types of stories is that beloved people are separated and then they have to overcome overwhelming obstacles in order to get back together.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the Ramayana right there, the story of Ram and Sita separated and then brought back together following military conquest and adventure.
Yeah. I mean, it's there all through ancient literature, mm-hmm. you know, the novels of the Greco-Roman period. You have tons of stuff like this. But then to go into like, you know, modern manipulative cuteness cinema, I just think about how much of a sucker I've always been for stories of people being reunited with lost pets. It's just an undefendable weakness. I remember when I was a kid, the end of the movie Homeward Bound. You remember that movie?
Oh, yeah. I wasn't a huge fan, but my sisters loved it and would watch it over and over again.
I saw it multiple times because I was a kid when it was out and big and out on video. I think it was a good thing for parents or teachers to put on, you know. Mm-hmm. And it just destroyed me, like this sudden upwelling of uncontrollable happiness and tears at the scene, spoiler alert, where this fictional trio of pets, two dogs and a cat, you know, after a great journey are reunited with they're fictional humans.
There is an excellent Futurama episode titled Jurassic Bark that evokes the same sort of feeling in me every time I rewatch it, even though it is a comedy, it's a farce. And despite the fact that it expressly dodges such a reunion, like the reunion between the human and the dog does not occur, but it has such a bittersweet ending where it is shown that the reunion wanted to happen, I guess you could say. And another weird example of this and I know you've seen this is and this one probably works due mainly to the musical choice, but the ending of the Simpsons episode Radioactive Man, in which the director returns to Hollywood after this grueling experience of filming on location in Springfield, where everybody, the politicians, the townspeople, they're all taking advantage of these poor Hollywood types. And then he comes back and he's welcomed back into Hollywood with open arms. And then the Bill Withers classic Lean on Me begins playing. And then they pan out, and it's a satirical moment, but clearly they're playing with this idea of Hollywood versus small town morality, etc. But since they're playing Lean on Me, it gets me every time. Like, it makes me feel all the feels despite the satirical nature of the content.
Oh, that song is like the perfect Kamamuda song.
Oh, it is.
Lean on Me When You're Not Strong. Yeah, it's about trust and depending on each other. Yeah.
It's just pure uncut Kamamuda.
And I would also say there seem to be major genres of internet media that are based entirely on exploiting people's desire to feel Kamamuda-like emotions at the push of a button over and over again. It's like your cocaine button in the rat cage, except it's Kamamuda, the Upworthy style of stuff. The video is titled, like, he almost kicked a turtle into the trash compactor, but what happens next will melt your heart.
Yeah, and you want to click because, yeah, I'm like, okay, I want to have my heart melted. Let's do it.
Yeah. But this kind of content is incredibly potent for virality. When there are these like studies about what kind of content actually goes viral, there's a reason that these media companies went for content like that, because that stuff hits the button. I mean, I think because of our negative view of virality, we often tend to think of like kind of nasty memes as being the most viral content. But this Kamamuda exploitation video stuff is hugely viral.
Yeah, to come back to the Cormac McCarthy quote about the snowflake and the fleeting nature of the feeling, like one solution is, well, it's all right. There are a lot of snowflakes in the air. I would just run around all day catching them and do nothing else just to get that hit after hit after hit of good old-fashioned Kamamuda feeling. And luckily there's a machine in my hand with a program that is designed to do nothing but
just keep clicking. Yeah. I mean, I guess I don't know. Maybe there are downsides that I'm not thinking of. I mean, I guess it's better that people keep watching stuff like that. They go down some horrible radicalizing YouTube trail or something and end up a member of the anti-human front or whatever.
Anti-human, but pro Baby Yoda. That's where you end up landing, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Next study, just quickly. This is one called Moment-to-Moment Changes in Feeling Moved Match Changes in Closeness, Tears, Goosebumps, and Warmth. Time Series Analysis, published in 2018 by Schubert et al. This study looked at the moment-to-moment sensations, like body sensations of people experiencing what the researchers believe to be Kamamuda, as evoked by video clips showing scenes meant to display these intense communal sharing relationships, these moments when these relationships intensify. And the study found strong and consistent cross-correlations between clips that people scored with Kamamuda-associated words, like moved or touched, distinct from clips that were judged as merely happy or sad. This is like a separate thing than being happy or sad. And that the Kamamuda clips were associated with moment-to-moment physiological symptoms or sensations of tears or moistness in the eyes, goosebumps or chills, and feelings of warmth in the center of the chest.
Mm.
So again, back to what we were talking about earlier. There were a couple of studies that looked at cross-cultural analyses, basically like, is there a similar thing going on across different languages and cultures? There was one study that looked at the United States, Norway, China, Israel, and Portugal, published in the Journal of Cross-Cultural Psychology in 2018 by Siebert et al. And this just generally did find that there was a lot of consistency across the different cultures. And then there was another one published in the journal Emotion in 2019 by Zickfield et al., looking at 19 different nations across 15 different languages, 3,542 participants, to see if there was consistency about which types of experiences evoked Kamamuda-like emotions. To read from their abstract, quote, "Our results are congruent with theory and previous findings showing that Kamamuda is a distinct positive social relational emotion that is evoked by experiencing or observing a sudden intensification of communal sharing. It is commonly accompanied by a warm feeling in the chest, moist eyes or tears, chills or piloerection, feeling choked up or having a lump in the throat, buoyancy and exhilaration. It motivates affective devotion and moral commitment to communal sharing. While we observed some variations across cultures, these five facets of Kamamuda are highly correlated in every sample, supporting the validity of the construct and the measure." So it looks like this is, at least according to this research we're looking at so far, this is a pretty universal emotion, and that we might have some different words for it across different cultures, but there's something pretty consistent going on about like what types of things we can see or be a part of and what kinds of feelings it gives throughout the body and what kind of behaviors it triggers in us afterwards.
So what do we learn by naming and characterizing an emotion?
We sort of started off by talking about this a bit.
Yeah. And, you know, I have to say that this my initial reaction to this topic, not being familiar with the particular concept, with the named concept of Kamamuta, my initial response was, what good does this do us? Why do we need this? I'm not to say that I was completely biased against it, but because I'm but the thing is, I'm clearly already experiencing these emotional states, right? But for more nuanced reasons, with more nuanced terminology, do I really need a catch-all Sanskrit term to refer to them? And that's been something I've been just trying to figure out. Now, certainly, I'm not opposed to bringing in Sanskrit terms or Sanskrit loan words or words from say Hindu or Buddhist religion. Because I think that a lot of times these are very useful terms, such as things like say Brahman and Samsara. I think these can be incredibly helpful, and they certainly stem from a language and a culture that devoted a tremendous amount of mental energy to contemplating psychological and metaphysical concepts. Mm-hmm. But in this particular instance, does Kamamuta like really help us out? I could not help but think about another case in which we have reached out to another language for a term that were lacking in English to describe an emotional, very specific emotional state, and that is the German concept of Schadenfreude, mm-hmm. Which is the pleasure derived by someone from another person's misfortune. Like, we don't have a specific term for it, like a single word for it in English, but in German they have it. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of useful, I think, to be able to take Schadenfreude out of the German language and then use it as a way to reflect on how we're feeling about things in our life.
Well, the fact that we now have a loan word for it in English, I think that makes it much easier for us to recognize when it's happening.
Yeah, to say I am feeling Schadenfreude and not something more useful like actual sympathy, to be able to draw a line between sympathy and Schadenfreude despite the fact that they are they're very connected. Like, yeah. You know, it's the kind of the flip side of the coin. This gives us, again, the power to label it, to discuss it, to pull it aside, and even then lean into the more positive side of the coin, to lean into sympathy.
Yeah.
But that brings us back to Kamamuta, because instead of going from broad to specific, as we're feeling with Schadenfreude, how does Kamamuta help us? How does it help us to be able to go, instead of from the large to the small, to go from the small to the large?
Well, I mean, I think one thing, if they're on the right track, I mean, obviously these researchers could maybe be wrong about this, but you know, it looks like there's a body of research building up here that's pretty supportive of the idea that this is actually a fairly consistent phenomenon across cultures. There are these like things linking all these disparate phenomena. And there are, of course, plenty of emotional states that are broad, like happiness is extremely broad. The situations that cause happiness are you know, you can't list them all.
Right. But then again, nobody's coming along and saying, hey, I want to tell you about this new concept. Yeah. It's called happiness.
Right.
The only one thing that did come to mind that reminded me a little bit about this, though, is via a, say, partial understanding of serotonin or media overuse of serotonin, a discussion of serotonin, we end up reminding ourselves of neurotransmitters in regard to any given emotional state, you know, where certain.
What do you mean?
I'm saying like nobody's going to come along and have to explain to you what happiness is.
Right.
But at some point in your life, someone like much later, someone might have come along and said, hey, let me talk to you about that happiness and what you're and let me tell you about serotonin's role in how you're feeling.
Are you saying like giving you a good explanation of serotonin's role or giving you an oversimplified
version of it, which I think is the version that we often encounter, certainly just in the media at large, and perhaps we encounter for the first time, combined with
like,
sort of
I need more serotonin, then I can be happy.
Right. Yeah. Or it's also just kind of like when you first hear about it, you will probably have an incomplete understanding of it, and that may also lean into this understanding of it. So on one level, it's kind of a making something familiar new again with new terminology. I wonder if Kamamutas kind of provides that. It kind of takes this sort of broad area of the feels and gives them a new term, and then ultimately it does allow us to potentially analyze it anew, to think of it in a new light without actually recategorizing it as something drastically different.
I mean, I think, again, if the researchers are on the right track here, I think one thing that could be useful about it is that when you identify a phenomenon where a bunch of things that previously looked unrelated are actually very related, new cause and effect relationships occur to you as possible and you can start testing for them. So, for example, one thing that seems to come out of this is that Kamamuta seems to, at least in some of this research, motivate a sense of increased community with the objects of whatever you're watching. So if you watch a video of two people having this moment that makes you feel the Kamamuta, you feel increased community. You don't just feel the feels in your chest and all that. You feel increased community with the people in the video.
I think another potential way to look at this in a positive way would be when you don't understand what's bringing people together.
Yeah.
Say you turn on the news and there are some protesters and you don't agree with what they're protesting about, or you're on the other side of their protest and you need to understand them. Or if you, like me, are not a like team sports person and you find everyone else in your city is obsessed with the local soccer team. Or let's say you're not a religious person and you see footage or you see friends and family engaging in a religious experience or going to church. And maybe you don't completely understand what they're doing, but if you define it all under Kamamuta, you can look to the examples of Kamamuta that you do engage with, and then potentially have a better understanding, or at least some understanding of why people are united in protest here, why people are in a house of worship here, or why people are all wearing the same color and going to a coliseum here.
Right. To understand that, you know, you might not get what people like about sports, but there's some similarity in the feelings in the body and the pleasure that pervades your brain when you experience cute kitten videos that other people do when they're part of a team sports thing.
Yeah, everything is Baby Yoda, basically. That's the thing to drive home. If you don't understand it, just remind yourself that's Baby Yoda too. All right, so there you have it. Kamamuta, obviously we would love to hear from everybody about this because this concerns a broad categorization of human emotion that we can all relate to. So hit us up with your examples, your thoughts, your contemplation on what we've discussed here. Does the term Kamamuta, does that help you? or do you feel like it is in some way a hindrance? I don't know. We're open to discussion on all of that. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find us wherever you find your podcasts. The Mothership is no longer with us, but you can still go to stufftoblowyourmind.com, and that will redirect you to the iHeartMedia listing for our podcast. But wherever you get the podcast, just make sure you rate and you review and you subscribe. These are the three acts of devotion that help us out in the long run.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, just to say hi, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.